welcome to the Tortoise Shack Live, our weekly Sunday special, which we do with a live audience of our favourite people who are our patrons. If you want to be here next week, it's really easy. You just go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and sign up. And you can be here asking questions, giving in pieces on the discussion, and just generally having the crack. It's our favourite podcast of the week. So do join us. And we have a Q&A session at the end for the patrons only. So, you know, there is extra stuff that you get with that. I am your host this week, Linda Hayden from the Pack Woman podcast, and I'm delighted to be joined by Tonia Martin from the Echo Chamber podcast and Dr. Vicky Conwee from Policed in Ireland. We have a lot to get through because God forbid we would ever have a slow news week in these crazy times. So we'll kick off a bit. Tony, you're a bit of a financial expert, aren't you?
Well, I'm qualified in this, but that doesn't make me an expert.
Tell us a bit about what happened this week with GameStop and stocks and bonds and all sorts of weirdness going on.
It was just basically one of the main skills in financial markets is to actually make things sound more complicated than they are. So you have people who create different funds and shell funds and micro funds and ways of basically glamorizing what is in effect usually gambling, and a lot of it is gambling, and quite a lot of what they've done is you just had a gang of lads who got together and avoided. They were trying to short sell a stock, which basically meant they were going to be able to take up whatever money they bloody wanted by saying, this thing is, we're selling it out there at $1 billion and we're going to buy it back at $300 billion. We're going to recoup all that taking. But you had kids in their parents' bedrooms buying up the stock and inflating the price. So it went, instead of being $1 billion, it was $1.4 billion or $1.5 billion. And then Wall Street started to shit itself going, oh God, this shouldn't happen. We're losing out here. And they suspended trading, which is, you know, when you think about it, it does go very much to the heart of there's problems already with people in the US looking at going, well, one rule for one rule for the other. You know, we have to take the losses when we lose out. And they really just let them off the hook in many ways. But it's quite funny. But it's also a little bit of an eye opener to how volatile the market is. I mean, the market is, when you think the global financial crisis just before it, we were seeing record bond record valuations, and we surpassed all of that during a global pandemic, which means there's a bubble, as Konstantin Gordiev refers to it, and it's that volatile, it's that easy to manipulate, especially in the new world where you can organize a few hundred people on Reddit can get nearly, you know, a few thousand people active, and it really worked a treat, and we all got a laugh out of it. And the only people, well, we won't be laughing now if your pension fund is struggling, and you're like, well, actually that pension fund probably is managed by some sort of REIT who's buying up all the properties in Dundrum and costing us all a fortune to bite the rent. So there's a lot going. It's all interlinked, and it's all really, really, really ugly. But it was just quite amusing to say, you know, as Martin put out, you know, think of the poor billionaires, folks. Think of the poor billionaires.
It was a real thing of like, oh, you know, poor people should be doing this kind of stuff. And then as soon as they started, it was like, no, stop. Stop that.
Not like play our game. This is our game. Stay away.
But I just thought, and even the fact that it was GameStop, like, why?
Just shows you, though, doesn't it, that the power that you can actually, you know, you can yield. And it's not the first time things like that have happened. There's been great ones where the smaller ones are done by a gang in New Zealand. Teenagers in New Zealand took down stocks, were taken, they've suspended trading on other stocks. So it's not unusual, but this was just quite funny because they managed to make Wall Street go into a tailspin, and it dominated social media.
Like, it is a really big thing, isn't it, about all of this being presented as like really complex and inaccessible and not for the little people. I mean, like, I love the movie The Big Short for this very reason. You know, they have her sitting in the bubble bath explaining shorts to you and saying, like, it's actually easy. You're just getting distracted by me. But that point of this all becoming more accessible and like kind of demystifying it, and it's not an elite game that, I mean, I have a brother who works in finance. I remember the day where I was like, so like the stock markets are really about emotions, just like whether somebody's got a good feeling or is nervous, or he's like, yeah. Like, okay.
Just on that point, though, just to bring this little bit to a close, the stock market, like, I know people who've made a fortune. I mean, like, literal fortunes from being able to manipulate more behavioral economics than economics in many ways. And if they moved enough people to one direction, the momentum took such way that they actually, I remember one guy, this is true, back in the Anglo days, he bought 4 houses. Out of the money he made from a few trades over the course of, I think it was 6 weeks, 4 houses.
Ew. So,
yeah.
Ew.
I know the guy. I like the guy, but my God, you know.
Who needs 4 houses, for fuck's sake?
Well, it was another way of just saying, no, well, now this is the way of, I've got this money coming and I don't want to, I need a different thing to do with it. So yeah, that's what he did.
I mean, probably the worst investment he could have made, right, at the time, but...
Yeah, buying for cash though. So rental income for the rest of your life. Anyway, we better move on.
I just want to very briefly touch on my podcast this week is out today, and it is with Erin Darcy from In Her Shoes. And we touch on this in it. So I think it's kind of important. You know, back in, I think it was October, they implemented a full ban on abortion in Poland. The only two exceptions were if the it was as a result, the pregnancy was as a result of crime, or if the woman's life was in danger. But the criteria for proving that is actually really, really narrow. So it's in effect a full ban. There was mass protests back then, huge movement, people out on the streets protesting against it. And they paused it, but they sent it to a tribunal, and the tribunal has upheld the law. So now there is a full abortion ban in Poland. So we have a right-wing government who are determined to pull Poland back to the old ways, to plumage the older Catholic voters there, to try and keep them in power. So just to be aware, we have our own legislative review coming up, and ARC, the Abortion Rights Campaign, are looking for people to get involved with that. So Vicky, I'll go to you.
Yeah, just everyone please join ARC. Like, there are so many problems with the legislation we have, the 3-day waiting period, the difficulty it causes for minorities and people who don't have visas. Like, there's just tons of problems with it. It is working well to a certain extent, but there are loads of issues with it, and ARC are doing incredible work, and everyone needs to join ARC and just be very aware. This is the 3-year review. It's not often we get that kind of opportunity with legislation. It was really important that it was written into it. So this is big and it's important. So please engage.
One of the other things is ARC are running a survey. If anybody has accessed abortion within Ireland since, I think it was January 2019. There is a survey. If you have, please help them, because it will help them to identify where the issues are and where we need to push for the legislation, because we're not going to get an opportunity to vote on this or have any input into this legislation unless we start pushing our TDs, and that's what we're going to have to do with this. So it's really important. Go have a look at abortionrightscampaign.ie. You can sign up there, see what's happening and get involved. So we would encourage everybody to do that. So just wanted to quickly mention that. We're going to move on to Zero COVID, and delighted to be joined by Tomás Ryan, who's a neuroscientist at Trinity College Dublin and a Zero COVID advocate. So Tomás, thank you so much for coming on and joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I believe we have a campaign kicking off tomorrow, is that right?
That's right. So as many people are aware, there's growing support for a zero COVID style elimination strategy in Ireland. I think it's fair to say the majority of the population either explicitly support zero COVID or support the measures that would deliver zero COVID in Ireland. But there's a perception that the voices that have been advocating for zero COVID are a small minority of scientists and academics, and that aren't really communicating necessarily the breadth of opinion and the breadth of voices in the community. So today is the launch of the We Can Be Zero campaign, which is essentially a people's campaign. It's being coordinated by Simone George and Grace Dias. The launch webinar will be tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. We have a Twitter account. Anyone can join online now. And the idea is that we want to provide a voice for individuals who don't feel like their voice is being heard by their TDs or by the counselors or by their lobby groups, and to see how much community support there is for a zero COVID strategy. Because the more awareness of community coherence behind it, the faster that we can get there, and essentially the more effective this lockdown can be, and the more likely that this can be our last lockdown. And it's important to remember what zero COVID means. One way of thinking about it is it's not absolute zero, and it doesn't mean zero risk. It's more like a fire, because, you know, a disease like COVID-19, it spreads so much, it's like a fire, it doubles and doubles and doubles. And in Ireland, it's fair to say that we have a zero fire policy. We have zero tolerance of fires. We usually don't have fires. When a fire happens, the fire brigade comes and puts it out. And when the fire brigade comes, it puts it all the way out. It doesn't leave one room of your house on fire and say, we have to balance, you know, working with surviving the fire, so get back to work. We put out the fire entirely, and we never allow the fire to spread to other buildings. That's what zero COVID is. It's still going to occasionally come in, but that's why we quarantine cases to keep them out. And the occasional times where it does seep through, as is happening right now in some parts of Australia, you have quick, local, aggressive measures to get rid of it, which may only last a couple of days. You trace every case like it's a murder. And we can only do that by hyper-resourcing our public health physicians in Ireland. So all of this is possible. Zero COVID has three components. One, crush the curve, which is lockdown, and we're in a long lockdown anyway, whether we like it or not. Two is quarantine. Contain new cases so we don't get new variants coming into the community as well that may be vaccine resistant. And the third is chase, so chasing it when it arises in the community. We think that if we start doing this now, we could begin to open up cautiously by April, and then have a relatively normal summer ahead of us. Not completely normal, but relatively normal. And the crucial thing is it also provides security for the future. If we do get widespread vaccination, returning the world, returning Europe to normal by November, that's brilliant. But if we don't, we would still have a secure situation which would allow normal life to continue on the island of Ireland.
Tomás, can I just ask, what do you think the reticence is from the government to implement in a zero COVID? Like, why are they dragging their heels on it so much?
I mean, I don't know is the answer, but there are many reasons why it might be the case. One is a misunderstanding of what zero COVID is. Some people think it's theoretically impossible for reasons that we're not exactly like New Zealand and so on. And we're not exactly like New Zealand, but there's about 1.5 billion people on Earth who live in a zero COVID situation, not just New Zealand. I think we're much more like the Australian situation, to be honest. The other is that I think there's a sunk cost fallacy, because the reality is if zero COVID works now, it means it would have worked back in the summer, would have worked in March, April, and everything that we've done so far could have been optimized. I think a part of leadership is admitting when the wrong decision was made, when things can be improved. That's what we're hearing right now from the Portuguese Prime Minister. He said the other day that we got it wrong. We didn't make the right decisions, and we didn't communicate the right messaging. And they're changing their strategy. And right now they've imposed 2-week quarantine on people coming from Ireland to Portugal. And this is going to happen in Germany too. And Belgium have effectively closed their borders. So the idea that we can't do this because we're a part of the European Union is a nonsense. But I think the admitting that we're wrong, admitting that we need to learn, political humility for all of us is important. Many of us at the ISAG were wrong about many things. I was advocating strongly in the summer for airport testing as though that would be a solution. No country in the world has prevented seeding of the virus into their country by airport testing. You have to do the mandatory hotel travel quarantine. The other reason why I think that we have a resistance to it, and I think this is the substantive reason that we actually do need to face, is a fear of failure based on the resourcing of our public health infrastructure. We know that we can do a lockdown that will get us to zero cases or near, because we've done that before. We know that we can implement mandatory hotel quarantine, because 90% of people in the Republic of Ireland want it and 90% of people in Northern Ireland want it. Although the unionist voices in Northern Ireland want Britain to be exempt, which actually goes a long way there to get control of our situation. The problem is the third component, the chase component. This is identifying cases, test, trace, isolate. Now, public health has been neglected in Ireland for a very long time. And there is concern that this infrastructure is not going to be working well enough. This was articulated by Professor Philip Nolan this morning on News Talk with Gavin Riley. This is not an acceptable reason not to do zero COVID. What we're hearing is that from the people who know about this is that we can't do it because of our own incompetence. That is not adequate. We have 65 public health physicians in Ireland. They're the ones managing the outbreaks. They're supported by our impressive testing capacity. They're supported by our contact tracers, but these are the operators who are managing what's happening. We need to hyper-resource them. Give each of them 10 administrative assistants and 10 junior doctors. Give them a new IT infrastructure. Give them everything that they need to be chasing cases. And it would be a different world, because we wouldn't be testing thousands a day, because you'd only be getting a handful of cases when they emerge. It's a different type of thing. You need pop-up test centers. You need to get rid of GP referrals. You need to test everyone in the community rapidly, and you need to bring in antigen testing. We could talk about it for an hour. The point is, that's not an excuse. We need a private sector mentality for making our public health infrastructure as good as it is in Australia. And we do have the skills to do that.
So just we spoke to Marie Cassidy yesterday, and she made a great point about that, empowering local public health officials in local, you know, in their counties, as opposed to having a central monolith, and they know where the people are, and how you train up people to do effective contact tracing and maintaining that. The other thing that's important to point out, and here's a bit of a plug, on Wednesday we're going back to Portugal to speak to one of the members of the Portuguese government about their the idea of humble government, which they've spoken to before, and they have closed their border on Friday with Spain. A huge land border is now closed. So, you know, let's not kid ourselves and say that. I know that Tánaiste made the point that EU citizens have certain rights. Well, Schengen went away last summer, and Schengen has effectively been put on pause right now. In many ways, that is the case. So no, and just to let people know, it's going to be, I know Grace is in the audience, and she's one of the leaders of this campaign. We will be adding the blurb on the blurb. You'll have the link to this. So click on it, share it, let people know. Because the only thing, and as I know Simon Magara is there, and he taught us all about how to effectively campaign to get things to change, is when the government feel that the public pressure, the swell of public pressure is too much, they will change direction. And it, you know, it's campaigns like this that can do it. Sorry, Linda.
So the weather. 1:30 tomorrow is the meeting, and Tony is not actually going to Portugal, just to clarify.
So you go to wecanbezero.com. That's where you'll find all the information for the meeting tomorrow at 1:30 for the launch. So Tomás, thank you so much, and will you stick around for the Q&A, because I'm sure there's going to be tons of questions.
Sure.
Thank you. So we will move on a little bit now to something that there was a little bit of good news and a little bit of bad news. Well, not a little bit of bad news, a lot of bad news on this week. So, Vicky, what happened with the report into the Northern Irish mother and baby homes?
Okay, so the first thing to say, like, this is the good news part. It's not the ultimate report. So it was the kind of where Ireland was 6 years ago when we didn't have, imagine if we didn't have the work of Catherine Corliss, but somebody said, lads, we maybe need to look at this. So a working group was put together, which has had a difficult time. It's had three different chairs over the course of the working group. And the working group reported this week. And it's really encouraging, even the response to it. So both the report itself, and I'll talk about some of the points about that, but the recommendations of the report was everything from do nothing to have a full disclosure tribunal. But actually in the middle, what they had was let's have an inquiry that is co-designed by survivors. And the kind of amazing thing is that the Northern Ireland executive accepted that recommendation. I mean, let's just pause. The DUP accepted that recommendation. It's quite amazing. So that's what's going to happen. There's going to be a full inquiry. So the commission that we've just finished is about to start in the north, but the whole thing's going to be co-designed with survivors, which is kind of amazing. But the report that came out this week is really, really encouraging. So basically, the working group had employed researchers by open competitive tendered process to conduct like this preliminary research. Even that in itself is amazing. It's really well written. There's much more discussion of human rights. It's very frank around the difficulties of accessing records that are held by the orders. And it talks about how that secrecy harms survivors. It's very clear in the methodology it adopted, which we know the Irish report recently published was not. Rather than suggesting that trauma undermines testimony, it engages with those issues of memory and authenticity. The testimonies are reproduced anonymously at length, both in the report and in appendices. It has a very critical perspective on the adoption law. No kind of whitewash, there's no forced adoption here. And it specifically raises problems with cross-border adoption, which is something which I think the Irish report doesn't really engage with at all. It engages properly with the issue of the profits, saying maybe the laundry didn't get as much as we think, but there's definitely an issue there to be talked about. It takes, and I'm quoting Raiden right now, it takes women's agency very seriously throughout. So even talking about like attempts to escape were like a genuinely perceived exit route. And it even engages with some of the existing criticisms and analyses of the previous McAleese report. So like just all in all, it's what we'd hope for. It's what we'd want to see. And I suppose the question now is just like really willing that this is seen through. We haven't heard from survivors groups, but again, the really amazing thing, the report was published on Tuesday afternoon. Survivors had a meeting on Monday with the working group where they were given the report, and they had a whole 24 hours with it before it went to the executive. Imagine.
So basically everything that we should have had.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking to the chair of that working group. She's a former colleague of mine from the policing authority. She won't even call them mother and baby homes. She's like, they're not homes. There's nothing about them that was a home. I mean, it's just, it's a dream. So very encouraging, delighted for survivors in Northern Ireland that this first step has gone so well. And let's just really hope that the follow through is there and the resources are committed and it's taken seriously. The idea of a co-designed inquiry, because that's a new thing, it probably will require legislation. So that's a potential stumbling block about whether that would get passed. But the intention is to have experts facilitate the process of design and maybe try and do as much as what can be done within existing legal parameters. But so that's kind of the next step now, is moving into designing that with the experts and primarily with the survivors and developing what could be a really exciting new framework for conducting inquiries of these types of abuses.
Yeah, well, we live in hope that maybe we might get something like that here. Well, back to what we did actually get. Simon McGarr, welcome and thank you for joining us this morning. Talk to us about what has happened this weekend.
I suppose what's really happening is that we're getting the output of people reading the report and recognising what it says. I mean, when it was launched, everybody reported how many pages there were in, which is shorthand for I haven't read this yet. But one of the things that have caught attention in the last week or so has been the report's very brisk announcement buried inside the report on the confidential committee that it had destroyed almost all of the audio records of the testimony of the survivors and witnesses who had come in and given testimony to the commission. And it said that, and in the report it said, and we did that with their consent. So this was of news to some of the witnesses who emphatically say they did not consent. And one of them contacted me specifically to tell me, had I been told that my testimony would not go in an archive, would not be available for the future, and would be destroyed after I had given it, I would not have given my testimony. Now, that's really important because it's important from a point of view of in terms of data protection and what people's rights are over their own story. But it's also important to understand, what is the minister going to receive from the commission? You'll remember we had a very large brouhaha over this suggestion that these archives would be sealed for 30 years, that the report's records would be unavailable for people to access basically until most people had died. And that was defeated by public pressure and legal argument by the application of the GDPR, so that the government had to acknowledge they actually couldn't do that. They had to allow people access records relating to their own life, relating to themselves. Now, there are balancing and questions of proportionality where the records clash with other people's rights, but all of that it was to be dealt with within a GDPR context. So that was a major achievement, a huge achievement. Suddenly, these records went from being effectively inaccessible to they were going to be available to people as soon as the minister got hold of them. Now, what's happened is that it's become clear that by the time the minister puts his hand on this archive, it will have already been diminished from what it once was. The commission seems intent on redacting and, as we see, destroying information that they have collected as in the course of their inquiry. Now, there's a big issue about this. If you're going to have people relying on the minister's archive as the final source, this was the value that there was going to be. Even the minister has said this himself in the Dáil. This is a unique archive. It collects up records that have otherwise been spread across lots of government agencies. It also has a unique or had a unique collection of people's words and experiences, which would have been available for future generations. Even in the event that people did not want to make that information available instantly, it would at the very least have been available as part of a memorialization's process. Without those words, without that testimony, what we have is we have a questionnaire which was filled in by members of the commission or a representative of the commission. That questionnaire is not a verbatim account, and the Irish Examiner has confirmed that there were no stenography provisions made for these testimonies, that the only verbatim account was the audio, that the notes, the handwritten notes of the researchers were apparently destroyed also, so that there is no record of the actual testimony of people's words about their own life. Now, I think that's a terrible shame, but I also think that the basis on which it has been justified doesn't really seem to stand up to analysis. So if we're told that it was on foot of consent, that firstly raises the question, how was that consent obtained? And was it valid consent, full and valid consent? There are a number of steps you have to demonstrate under the GDPR if you're relying upon consent as your basis for processing. And destruction is a form of processing. I mean, storage is a form of processing, but destruction is a very significant form of processing. This is irrevocable. And so what we have here is an emerging story of a commission that seems to be whittling away at the information that will eventually be available to survivors following the GDPR's the acknowledgement that the GDPR applied to this once it reaches the minister. So you'll remember I was advocating, suggesting that people, if they are interested in accessing their data, should send in a request now to the commission rather than waiting for the minister to receive the archive. Because whatever there is remaining in the archive now would at least be frozen on the receipt of a subject access request.
Wasn't part of the reason why this came to light was that people disagreed with their stories as they were presented in the report. And so they went asking for these in order to be able to clarify. And that's when it was discovered that they had been destroyed.
Yes. I mean, there are at least two witnesses that I know of who have spoken about the fact that the information that they provided seems in one case, one described it as having been butchered when it was being cited in the report. And that appears to be, the report appears to be the only remaining archive of what people said. And that appears to be what will go forward into the memorialization process. So it's really significant, actually. I mean, I have not wanted to focus too much on the report as a political document. I think within days of the report being published, its political power was dead. And the government quickly moved on to saying, well, we're not going to follow those suggestions. We're going to do something else. But in terms of a statement of what the truth is for the archive, for the future, for future historians, I do think it's important that that report process is engaged with while we still can. Traditionally, reports, once they're produced, the commission that produces them winks out of existence. It has no further role and isn't available to answer questions. Unusually, this one will carry on until the end of February. I think this is a unique moment where that commission could be asked to explain its procedures and choices.
Vicky, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I mean, like, the worst of this is, and Linda knows this better than anyone, the ordeal it will have been for women to give evidence to the confidential committee in particular. Like, oh my God, they won't accept for a week before that. It will have taken everything out of them. And then to just have that destroyed, like, oh, it doesn't bear thinking about. It also, it reminds me, it's funny, like, whether they're using GDPR as a cover now, but like, I can think of so many instances where families have had concerns about abuses, let's say by the guards. And when they go to find the evidence, oh, it turned out that was destroyed, or oh, there was a fire in the station. Like, destruction of records is not a new phenomenon in Ireland for avoiding accountability. And really, I mean, I accept Simon's point that people should be writing in, but really, like, once this is known, the minister should be saying to the chair, can you please halt any destruction until we're satisfied with the procedures? And he really should have stood up already by now to do that.
It just seems
actually
like every
on the minister. Sorry, go ahead.
It just seems like everything has been, they had a set parameter for what this report was to look like, and they're squeezing everything to make it fit that parameter. It just seems like that feels like a Simon,
I think there was a very significant event that didn't get any press attention at all during the week, which is that the minister responded to a query from Thomas Pringle, TD. And the minister, for the first time that I know of, has conceded conceded what is the legal fact, that if it is the case that any national legislation would require records to be destroyed, or if it is the case that any national legislation would require records to be held in secret, where that national legislation clashes with the GDPR, the commission should set aside the national legislation and they should apply the GDPR rights directly. Now, this is simply a statement of legal fact, but the government has been always extremely slow to acknowledge that in their public statements, simply because it's an acknowledgement that there are limits to what can be made legal. And the state has never particularly been happy with that fact. That's one of the side effects of joining the EU, but they haven't been pleased about it. However, if the minister believes that to be true, which he does, and he says the Attorney General has given advices to that effect, that means, I think, that it is critical that the minister, as the person who will become the data controller in respect of this packet of information, should take action to ensure that the information that that reaches him is such that he can explain what is and isn't in the packet. Because once the commission winks out of existence, the question is, what is the final responsible body? And the answer is the state, if the data has not been properly processed.
Mm. We're going to have to move on, guys. We could talk about this all day, and I've a feeling it's not over yet by a long shot. So there's plenty more to come on this. Tony, I'm going to move to you. And to paraphrase Kermit the Frog, it's not easy to be green.
No. Just very quickly on what went down. I'm sure a lot of people saw on social media yesterday, I made a comment saying the Greens were going to ratify CETA. One of the funniest comments I received back from someone saying was that they said, nothing you've said is inaccurate. It's just misleading. And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? So the basic premise of this is it's not green policy. It remains not green policy. And in order for it to become green policy, it would have to be put to a vote. But Eamon Ryan seems, no, sorry, not seems. Eamon Ryan is intent on putting it on the floor of the Dáil with representational voting, where, you know, you bench the people who may be opposed to it. You put the other people forward, and we'll push through this legislation. We'll be coming back to it tomorrow, talking to Alice Mary Higgins about it. But nonetheless, they are intent on doing it. So I saw one of the former Greens who helped write some of the policy said, you know, we never even thought it could come to this, that they could ignore the written rules of the Greens. And he's looking to actually ignore the written rules. And this is, you know, so all of the crap that I took yesterday with all that nonsense and all the rest of it, nothing I said was wrong. Stand over it 100%. Stand over the entire thing, that this is what they've chosen to do, whether you believe... Simon mentioned Thomas Pringle. I said it to Thomas Pringle during the week, not making a decision is a decision. And there's a lot of Greens standing around not making a decision while Eamon is just going to march them, two of them into the Dáil is all he needs to. It's agreed at Cabinet, it's going to be done. And a lot of people are very hurt about it, and a lot of people feel their vote is betrayed. The Green Party themselves are really in trouble on this, because it's something that goes against their principles, and the idea that it's something. And as Peter Kavanagh said in his resignation letter, it would be one thing if Eamon was to say, listen, I'm against CETA, but this is what it's about being in government. You have to take the highs with the lows and you have to push on. But they're now saying, well, actually, CETA is a bit better than we thought it was originally. And it's been, you know, there's been this protection. There's not. There's a lot of woolly language in it. There's not. For social justice reasons alone, never mind environmental reasons, it's a bad thing. Second thing I really want to cover very quickly is Conor Dempsey and Stephen Donnelly. I think Stephen Donnelly has a nightmare of a week. We've seen today another story about him leaving the lads from Neffet on read, as they say, not responding.
Oh, no, giving them a thumbs up.
Yeah, not responding to their claims. Well, he's wanting to do interviews with people in newspapers, and you know, Hugh O'Connell covered it after we did the podcast, showing that there's a PR person who has received money from Stephen Donnelly. There's no two ways about it. He has been paid, and he was harassing people, is the language we've heard used, to the point where Anthony O'Connor deleted his Twitter account. The minister says this is a private individual acting in a private capacity. I put it to you that would not wash in any court of public opinion. Anybody who's looking at this reasonably and say, well, money has changed hands and this guy is at it. So it's just ridiculous that we're supposed to believe it. And again, credit to you, O'Connell. He's gone back to it a couple of times this week. I'm glad to see that people picked up on it and pushed forward. I'll shut up now. Sorry, Linda.
You're all right. All very, very valid points. And just to note that the Greens have lost 3 key county councillors in 2 weeks. That's, I don't think I've ever seen a party lose elected officials at that rate. So it is very much a hot topic within the Greens. And, you know, if people are sitting on the fence and have a good hard look at the things that some of your colleagues are saying, I think, you know,
it's, my timeline today, and I've already got people from the Greens telling me they've never seen any of this bullying harassment that you're talking about. Like, your party published an apology. So get in the sea.
I see you feel really, really strongly about that, Tony. Martin, we're going to come to you. So the UK are going to be giving us some vaccines, aren't they, sound?
Yeah. That was really interesting what happened with the EU this week. I mean, the notion that the EU mistakenly stumbled into triggering Article 16, absolute nonsense, complete and utter nonsense. It wasn't done by accident. It was done on purpose. As I said at the time, the Irish government, you know, panic stations, absolute panic stations. We're going to need vaccine from the UK. We're going to. And even if you put on, that's your first world head, and you look at it that way, we're going to need, and be very selfish. The first world is fighting about access to vaccine, when really and truly the bigger picture is we should be giving it to the third world and the first world, which can afford to lock down. And this comes back to what Thomas Ryan was saying. We should be locking down. We should be going for zero COVID and vaccinating the third world, because if we don't, all we're doing is starting this cycle where we'll be reinfected and reinfected and reinfected. the idea that it's not political, 50 people are dying a day, that is the most political thing that's out there. You cannot say this is not political. Zero COVID has been politicized, but not in the way that we're being presented by the government. The government has leaned more to the rat lickers than the zero COVID, and it's a timeline between zero COVID and rat lickers, and they're not in tune with the public. Public pressure can change that, but I'm beginning to feel that the obstacle with zero COVID is not that zero COVID won't work. It is simply that it'll put the government in a bad light for not doing it earlier. And there is a whole section of the media that would rather see 50 people dead a day than this government threatened. And that's absolutely astounding, but it's true. It's absolutely true. It's government at any cost. And if the cost is 50 people dead a day, they're quite prepared to take it on. The EU is beginning to teach a masticella on this whole subject. Every country is now doing its own thing. Ireland has historically been the best boy in class, and they're receiving no points for being the best boy in class. Nobody picked up a phone and said, we're going to trigger Article 16. It was simply landed on them. Complete panic. I think it's it foretells a rocky future. It foretells a really rocky future. It also says, stop being so passive. Ireland needs to stop being so passive. Start fighting your corner. Stop waiting for somebody to do it first. Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar are notoriously bad decision makers. They hate making decisions. And I think that's really why we are stuck where we are at the moment.
Can I just comment there that, like, I also think this is important to think about, not just in the context of vaccines, but in the context of Brexit more broadly, and how easily and how quickly, you know, these issues can be triggered and get really, really difficult. I mean, like, I was sitting there on Friday evening going, like, if this is actually real, like, we could see violence and bombings and all sorts so quickly. Like, yeah. You know, it just shows the absolute precarity of the position. Safety is not appearing as the priority in all of this.
It is. It's political game playing. And we lost badly. They were able to pull it back and, you know, take the trigger was pulled. And people have to be very clear about this. The trigger was pulled. But somehow they got a bulletproof jacket up in front of the bullet before it hit us. But that could happen again really, really easily. And particularly because we don't know what's going to happen with vaccines. It's a very unsure area. I can see this coming back again and again until we are out of this. But really, it's the wrong game altogether. The right game is vaccinate the third world first. Mm. That's the right game.
Guys, we're going to just move on to our heroes of the week. So, Martin, I'll start with you.
I think Simon McGarr, actually, and since as he's sitting here, I'll say Simon McGarr.
Oh, would you God.
No, but he does this. Oh, no, yeah. Seriously.
His head doesn't need that.
Yeah, but
who's the hero of the week? I don't know. My cup, but, my thing on my desk. Oh, that guy.
No, Lamp.
He also put up a little thread during the week. Which I read, I don't know if anybody else read it, was that, you know, about using your agency and how you use your agency to help other people. And I think that's very important. You don't always have to be paid for what you do. Sharing your knowledge is using your agency. And I think Simon's very good at that. So, yeah, I'll say
he's all. He also would like to get paid for what he does, too, though, in case anybody thinks otherwise.
Yes, he does. He does like to get
paid. Point taken. Vicky?
I have two. So firstly, Ciarán Gallagher, barrister from Dublin originally, Queen's Counsel in England. She would have defended the Hillsborough families at the inquest. And she has now stepped in up and said, you know what, we can do it better. And she's becoming an assistant coroner in one of the districts in England. And this is just the best news ever for families. And she's such a powerhouse and a queen. And she's amazing. But my other hero of the week, one we all really need right now, is that legend that is the goddess Bridget. Because, oh dear God, has fucking January been long. And like, I'm just spring tomorrow. Bring it on. Like, I'm Bridget. I'm channeling her. I'm putting my brat out tonight. And we need it. Come on. Yeah.
How can it still be January? That doesn't seem to make sense.
Right?
18. There's been 18 Sundays in this January.
Tony, who's your hero of the week?
I'm going to be really light about it. I got, I was out for my run this morning in the bitter cold and it was lashing down and I'm coming along the river road and the bus driver opened his window and shouted, "Put your top on, you dope."
He's our hero of the week.
I had to take my earphones off and ask him to repeat it and he did.
Simon, do you want to give yours? Do you have a hero this week?
I mean, I'll choose the witnesses who contacted me and decided to share the story about something that was not a happy experience for them and which has been the source of additional pain, which was their giving their testimony to the confidential committee and now wrestling with the consequences of that and still trying to make sure that their voices are heard. I mean, you would throw your hat at it sometimes. You'd think, why should I keep banging my head against this wall? And yet they wanted to have their story heard. So, you know, that's the best you could hope for from.
Yeah, fully agree. They're very, very brave women.
And then Dave, yours?
My hero of the week is there's an organization that's just started called Ciartas, who are doing sterling work for victims at IBSA in getting their images removed. They've managed to destroy one particular blog that was notorious. The forum on it was notorious for IBSA and sharing images without people's consent. And they've destroyed that. It's gone from 500,000 users down to 347 members. So I think they're doing sterling work. I'm seeing some really great stuff. There's been stuff passed to the Berlin police and everything. So they are my hero of the week. And if you have any issues with IBSA, you can get them on Twitter and Instagram. It's at Ciartas. So Ciartas, and go have a chat to them. They're really good people. So we have come to the end of the normal listeners podcast. Have a great week. Enjoy yourselves. If you want to be here for the Q&A, which is going to be cracking, do go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and sign up. And you can be here next week. Anyone who wants to just throw some questions into the chat and we'll be opening up some mics. And I hope you all have a great week.